tumbler from the small table to our left, sipped his Pappy Van Winkle's Family Reserve, and licked his lips so as not to lose a drop.
"Yes, it is."
"Are we celebrating something?" He lifted his glass.
"June 6, 1944.
"That was last week." He continued to hold his glass out to me. I nodded and touched the rim of mine to the old Doolittle Raiders.
"D-Day."
He studied me.
"Any dates you recollect from that war of yours?"
"January 30th, 1968. He looked at me, puzzled. "Tet offensive." He angled a knight toward the border.
"Any good dates?"
I mustered out August 3rd, 1972, and thought about it. "I've got a question for you."
"Shoot." "Do you remember the day your plane got shot down?" "I remember the minute."
"The day you were captured by the Japanese?"
"Yep, why?"
"George Orwell used to say that the English people do not retain among their historical memories the name of a single military victory."
"Commie."
I laughed. "In his own way, he fought a battle against totalitarianism that is as long-lasting as Churchill's, against the language of fascism, at least." His dark eyes came up to mine.
"What in the hell are you talking about?"
Angling left, I took his bishop. "Human nature, I mean, when you think about it. Hardly any of the epic poems or books are about victorious battles. The Iliad, The Charge of the Light Brigade, The Lost Battle, A Farewell to Arms, Drummer Hodge." He grunted.
"In answer to your question, successful and prosperous cultures have the luxury of looking back at death and defeat with a sense of nostalgia, having won the overall war."
I moved my monarch after his rook. "You don't think it's just a form of atonement for having participated in war in the first place?"
"Not if it was a good war."
"Define the term good war."
"The ones we won."
"So Korea was not a good war?"
"That was a tie."
Pursuing with the Queen, I noticed his knight lying in ambush.
"The Indian Wars?"
He studied me and then lifted his glass, taking a long, slow sip.
"You mind if I ask where all this horse shit is coming from?"
"One of the residents up at the veterans' home passed away a couple of nights ago. Charlie Lee Silwater."
"The colored fella?"
Yep. Anyway, he had a lot of Custer books, and then there was one of the movies on at Henry's Bar last night with Robert Shaw, I believe. As expected, he brought out the knight.
"My God, that one was horrible."
He made a face.
"But not as bad as Ronald Reagan in Santa Fe Trail, where they had him as Jeb Stuart's goofy buddy in 1859, when everybody knows Custer didn't graduate from West Point until 1861.
I angled my queen away. My point being that the preoccupation with Custer... He touched his knight again and then settled on his king, sensing a danger.
"Was personal propaganda is what it was, a brilliant campaign by a widowed wife. Libby Custer was relentless."
Drawing on his distracted attention, I moved my own king back.
"She assembled her husband into a shining example to American youth. Turned him into a hero. Heroes are big business. Just look at all those ball-playing assholes on television selling shoes, soap, soup, and nuts."
Bringing my queen back, I tightened the noose. "I don't follow."
"In the later part of the 19th century, we were moving away from a community and regionally based economy to a national one. Nationwide business is big business, and for that you needed an image, and men like Custer fit the bill. Hell, he was on cigars, soap, and posters. I even had a pedal car with his name on it when I was a kid."
What if the image was false? Ignoring the queen, he moved his king again.
"Who's to say if the image was false?"
"He was actively engaging in genocide, Lucian."
"Says who?"
"History." Nudging my queen forward, I announced, "Check." He looked disgusted. "Either way, there's right and there's wrong."
"Easy to say, sitting here playing chess in comfortable chairs and drinking my antiquarian bourbon."
I moved my queen again. "Check." The old sheriff sighed.
"I don't think he was as blundering an ass as he's portrayed, but in the heat of battle he made a dreadful miscalculation."
He reached out and toppled his king. "And for that, he paid the highest price that can be paid." I lifted my glass. "Remember the Alamo?" He lifted his.
"Amen, brother."
Chapter 3. It could either be a bad copy or a proof of some sort.
Proof of what?
No, just a proof, like an artist's study.
I watched as Barbara Schuster handled the canvas with white gloves in the conservation area of the Brinton Museum, carefully extracting it from waxed paper sleeves, and I felt bad about hauling the thing around rolled up in my jacket pocket. She reached up and adjusted a desk lamp with a circular fluorescent light and magnifying lens that was attached to the large table that dominated the room.
Well, from the action of the subjects, I would say that this is a study of a painting of a Western battle sometime in the mid to later part of the 19th century. The cavalryman is outfitted properly.
The Indian looks a little odd.
Yes. She lowered her glasses on her nose. Artists of that period, having never actually met an Indian, sometimes had some rather fanciful ideas as to their appearance. Many times the study would be done in an attempt to deal with problems involving light, color, form, perspective, composition,
costume.
Yes, that too.
He's kind of a combination of tribes, isn't he?
Yes, but like I said, a lot of times artists simply use their imagination, resulting in subjects that are somewhat far-fetched. But if this is a study for a larger work, then the final version might look completely different.
She flipped a toggle on the lamp, and I watched as it switched to a black light. So there's no way to tell who the artist might be or what piece of art this might have been a study from?
I'm afraid not.
She turned the canvas under the glow lamp again.
It's for a work in progress, and sometimes a great deal of the vitality of a piece of art can be gleaned from these types of studies, lending a fresh discovery or excitement to the work. It's almost like notes on how the artist became aware during the creation of the art, allowing us the opportunity to be a part of that creative process. But there would be no reason to sign it if that's the case.
There's no way this is a work of art unto itself.
Doubtful. I mean, if you look at the quality, you can see that the artist did this in something of a hurry and left out a great deal of detail, giving the impression that it is a work leading to an actual painting, if it was anyone of real repute.
Folding her arms, she sat back on the stool.
This was probably never meant to see the light of day.
What's it worth?
She stared at me.
Excuse me? What's it worth, a ballpark figure?
Her eyes went back to the square of canvas and crusty pigments. I'm no authority, and those types of financial assessments are usually made by experts in the field or people who can break up the molecular aspects of the paint or the canvas itself.
Just a basic idea.
Without any trace of the artist or history? I really can't say.
Is it worth a million?
A million what?
Dollars.
Goodness gracious, no.
He looked at me and laughed.
If you were planning on retiring on this, I'm afraid you're going to have to stick with being a sheriff.
I leaned in and looked down at it. So even if it was a prominent artist and a noteworthy painting, it wouldn't be worth that kind of money.
Well, if you were to, say, find one of Michelangelo's studies of the male model of the Libyan Sibyl from the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, it might be worth that much, but even then, you'd have a hard time certifying it.
Why?
The final rendering was female. Art changes and artists change their minds. She glanced at the painting again. And in all honesty, even though the artist is certainly capable, he or she was no Michelangelo.
I see. So, a couple $100?
At best.
Okay.
Do you mind if I ask what gave you the idea that it might be worth $1 million?
Just hazarding a guess.
I reached down and scooped the thing up along with the coverings.
You mind if I keep this stuff to protect it?
She stood. Not at all. And if you want a second opinion, we have a number of specialists in the field, appraisers who can perhaps determine the exact worth. Count von Lehmann, for one.
Count von Lehmann?
She smiled. More of our shirt-tailed Sheridan County royalty.
He's really a count?
Papal indulgence. He used to teach up in Bozeman and over at Sheridan College after he formally retired. She smiled. I once asked our conservationist, Larry Lowe, what kind of Count von Lehmann was, and he said, no count, but you might have him take a look at it. Last I heard, he was living over near Story in some strange house he built. I patted the packet surrounding the orphan art.
Not for a couple $100, I don't think.
Well, if you decide you want to hang it on the wall of your office, Larry can stretch it onto a frame for you. Old canvas can be awfully brittle.
I'll keep it in mind.
Pulling some of the books from a satchel on the stool beside me, I sat them on the counter. These are a few of the books he had. Any idea if they might be worth something? She examined the books, opening one and flipping through the pages. Harmson Collection, Volume 2, American Western Art, Visual Art of the Lakota, Early Illustrators of Western Art. There's some call for these, but not so much since they've been written in. She looked up at me. The owner? Was. Oh. From the notes in the books, would you say he was educated in art? She opened the book again and started reading. Possibly. If you want to leave some of them with me, I'll go through them and see what I can find. You're sure that's not too much trouble? Not at all. We took the elevator down to the ground floor, walking past the life-size display of Bradford Brinton. The new digs are pretty amazing. It's a long way from William Moncrief's original ranch house, huh? When did he sell the place to Brinton? 1923. Before my time. Mine, too. She extended a hand when we stopped at the glass doors at the front of the relatively new museum. I'm sorry if this turned out to be a disappointment, Walter, but it's a bit of unusual excitement, I suppose. The actual owner passed away over in Durant at the veterans' home, and I thought we should get a general idea of what it's worth. Still, not your usual line of work. I placed the art under my arm and extended a hand. Nope. She took my hand and we shook. Well, if I can be of any further assistance at all, don't hesitate. I won't, and thank you again. Heading out the door, I looked toward the edge of the parking lot where Vic sat on a bench watching Dog, who was standing in Little Goose Creek. Walking down the stairs, I angled toward the two and stopped beside her, placing my hands on my hips. Did you let Dog go swimming?
It was his idea.
She didn't move, her head lying back with the sunglasses covering her eyes, reflecting the intermittent sunshine that sparked through the thick-leaved cottonwood trees.
I guess he needed cooling off, or he decided to go fishing.
The inside of my truck is now going to smell like wet dog. I glanced around at the beautifully sculpted grounds near the little town of Bighorn in neighboring Sheridan County. You missed a beautiful museum.
Yeah, I just don't like museums that much. I spent my whole childhood back in Philadelphia going to museums and, of course, visiting the Liberty Bell.
See the bell a lot?
Every school year since sixth grade. We're on a first-name basis.
She stretched her legs out and crossed her boots as Dog dipped his head and gulped a gallon or two.
I don't know what the big deal is. I mean, it's got a crack in it.
So I've heard.
What do they say about your painting?
A couple of $100 at best.
Her eyes went back to Dog. Sell it to him and we'll go have lunch.
I don't think they want it.
Too bad.
She stood and stretched, her uniform shirt coming loose and revealing her lean torso.
So who is this Bradford Brinton guy?
Born in Illinois, Brinton got a degree from Yale and went into business with his old man as vice president of the Great Detour Plow Company, which merged with J.I. Case Threshing Machines.
Case as in the Case?
Yep. He enlisted and took part in the Meuse-Argonne and some offensives in World War I and bought this ranch in 1923. He was married and had two daughters and died in Miami, Florida in 1936 of acute pancreatitis when he was 56. I glanced around. He left the ranch to his sister, and she used it as a summer home until 1960 when she turned it and the artistic contents over to the Northern Trust of Chicago, who administered it as the Bradford Brinton Museum. She peered down the creek as Dog ambled across the bank and looked up at us.
And that's the ranch house down there that we drove by?
Yep.
What's the other one farther down?
From what I'm to understand, his whoopee house.
Whoopee house?
He sometimes had women and liquor brought in.
You cowboys.
Shaking her head, she turned and looked back at the state-of-the-art $16 million museum as Dog drew closer.
And who built that?
Forrest E. Mars, Jr.
And who is Forrest E. Mars, Jr.?
Dog began shaking, filling the air with droplets that coated us. Have you ever eaten a Mars bar, Milky Way, or a bag of M&Ms? She wiped off her glasses with a shirt tail.
Sure.
Then in some small way you helped foot the bill for that museum.
Mars, as in Mars.
We started back for my truck with Dog in tow.
So Sheridan County is the main line of Wyoming?
In what way?
Old money.
I thought about it.
I guess so.
I looked out over Lake Desmet, the 3,000-acre body of water that runs along the Bozeman Trail at the base of the Bighorn Mountains, but I couldn't see it, even though I felt as if I were floating on it. Someone was talking to me, but I couldn't seem to respond. It was as if I opened my mouth, I might drown.
Maybe he won the lottery.
I jerked my mind back in hopes that she might not have noticed its absence. What? She glanced at her wristwatch. That was a short one, only 3 minutes. Maybe you are getting better. I sipped my iced tea, but said nothing. She gazed out at the small waves being decapitated by the wind. Who the hell knows? Maybe old Charlie Lee just invested wisely. I rested the iced tea back on the table. And the books and partial painting don't really mean anything. I'm just saying there may not be any mystery to all this. She looked out the lake stop windows at the restless water. It seems like you want there to be. I shrugged. I just want that $1 million to go to the right person. And I'd like to know where it came from.
Not your job.
What's that supposed to mean?
That's what we have lawyers and bankers for, not to mention the IRS.
I'm trying to help them along.
You're trying to do their job, which is why you're pissing them off.
I'm not pissing anybody off. There was a disturbance on the deck as a mother and father bickered, their voices rising.
Then where's your warrant?
I shrugged. I'm working on it. She sipped her Diet Coke, but then turned and gazed at me.
What did Vern Selby say?
I gestured out the window. He basically told me to go jump in said lake. She turned, self-satisfied, as we both studied the landscape past the combative parents. Our food arrived, and we sat there eating, relatively silent, staring through the glass at a few of the other tourists seated on the deck outside, their children making bright noises and racing about like barn swallows.
Is having kids overrated?
I was surprised by the question, but quickly recovered before stuffing more pork carnitas into my mouth. It has its moments, kind of like a tornado that goes on in your life for 20 years. She took a fry from her plate and popped it into her mouth.
Sounds like fun.
I chewed and thought about it as we watched the argument outside become even more heated. I was about to turn away when the woman, having waited until the man had gone to the railing to say something to the children below, looked directly at me and mouthed two words, "Help me."
Heard from your daughter lately?
A long moment passed as the man returned and leaned in toward whom I assumed was his wife. No, I guess she's busy.
Yeah.
He was quick, and we could hear the report of the blow as he smacked her, her face turning as she lifted a hand of her own to cover up, then turning to look at him in shock. I was already off my stool when the woman stood and backed away to the left, turning and running into the building and disappearing into the bathroom. Vic was standing to my left as I started off.
I'll check on her.
I said nothing, but continued toward the end of the bar and took a left, pushing through the glass doors and moving toward the umbrella-covered table where the angry man sat watching the two kids playing in the sandbox below the deck. Excuse me? He turned, and his eyes blinked only once. Could I see some identification, please? He continued to stare at me. Pulling my light jacket back, I revealed my star and kept very strong eye contact with him. I need to see some ID right now. Nodding a response, he hunched up and removed his wallet from his back pocket and flipped it open, pulling out a license and handing it to me with as much indifference as he could muster. But in the action, his jacket gaped, and I could make out a snub-nosed revolver tucked into his belt. Continuing to watch him, I glanced at the card and read, "Mr. Dean Gibson, San Jose, California." "Yeah?" I glanced back and could see Vic returning with the woman, a hand on her arm. "Do you mind coming with me for a moment?" He shook his head. "I'm not leaving my kids out here." As the two women arrived, I gestured toward the red-eyed one who had mouthed the words to me through the picture window. "Is this your wife, Mr. Gibson?" He glared at her, but she wouldn't look at him. "Yeah?" "Then I'm sure she and my deputy won't mind looking after the children while you and I talk." He glowered at the woman for a few seconds and then redirected his scowl at me as he stood.
All right, let's get this over with.
Gesturing for him to precede me, we walked toward the parking lot, and I quietly slipped my hand down to unsnap the safety strap on my Colt. When we got to the farthest table, I stopped with my hand on my sidearm. He turned to look at me, stuffing his hands into his jeans and rocking back and forth in his running shoes, exhibiting a little anxiety before smiling and breathing a quick laugh.
Listen, this isn't what it looks like.
I glanced at the license in my hand and waited a few seconds before responding. And what's that, Mr. Gibson?
She gets a little mouthy sometimes, and I can't have that in front of my kids, you know?
No, Mr. Gibson, I'm afraid I don't. The state has pretty clear rules about that kind of physical abuse.
Look, it's not like I make a habit of hitting her, all right?
The unauthorized application of force to another resulting in harmful or offensive contact, and seeing as how you did it under the eyewitness of law enforcement.
Aw, shit, come on!
Ignoring his remark, I continued, it's entirely at my discretion as to whether to charge you with aggravated assault and or battery. He said nothing more but just stood there, studying me. Are you armed, Mr. Gibson? He looked away and then brought his eyes back to mine. No. I let that one sit for a while, hoping he'd change his mind, but pretty sure he wouldn't. You sure about that? He ran a hand through his hair and then dropped the hand to his belt buckle within easy reach of the revolver.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I gave it another long pause as I closed my fingers around the stag grips on my Colt. Figuring he had no other options, he made his move, snatching for the revolver in his waistband, but my hand was just as quick, closing around his as I brought the large frame semi-automatic up with the other hand and slammed it under his chin, sending him over the railing backward as the .38 fell under the deck and skidded off the edge. I was around the railing and grabbing the front of his jacket as he tried to get up, swinging a roundhouse at me that glanced off my head and removed my hat. In the instant that my vision was blocked, he brought a foot up, catching me in the knee as I brought the Colt back around to hit the side of his head this time. Falling into a parked car, he kicked at me again, this time catching me in the crotch, which I guess had been his target all along. The air went out of me, along with the will to stand upright and not puke, but I was able to get a hand on his ankle as he slithered from the hood of the car. We both tumbled onto the surface of the gravel parking lot, and he kicked me again as I gripped my way up his legs, pounding him with the butt of the Colt. He finally quit kicking, and I was able to grab the collar of his jacket and lift his face up to mine. I was screaming something at him, but I wasn't sure what it was, something about women and children and guns.
Walt!
His head lolled to one side, and I was pretty sure he wasn't listening.
Walt!
Somebody was yelling my name from a long way off.
Walt!
Releasing my grip, I dropped the man and fell to the side, resting my back against the wheel of the car next to us. Taking a deep breath, I brought a hand up to my face and could feel the scuffed flesh at my jaw where he'd caught me at least once.
Walt!
I turned and looked up into the sun where a dark figure was outlined, holding a Glock 9mm on the two of us.
Yep. You okay?
I took another deep breath and felt the nausea fading just a bit.
Peachy, how about you?
I stared at the partial painting of the bonneted native that was laid out in the bar. Henry Standing Bear lowered his face to look under the brim of my hat at my jaw.
A good fight, huh?
I looked up from the artist's proof.
Depends on what you'd call good. You won.
Vic leaned forward, studying the other side of my face, as Dog raised up between us, eager to go home.
The amazing thing is you never lose teeth. That's handy and less expensive.
The bear leaned back, picking up the remote and lowering the volume on the TV in the otherwise empty Red Pony Bar and Grill.
So he was kidnapping his own family?
What used to be his family back in California. I gestured toward Vic, who had the story down a little better than me.
Divorced, right?
She nodded, and I noticed she was getting a little tipsy.
About a year ago, but I guess he never took it to heart. They went their separate ways, and she moved back to Ohio and took the kids with her.
About a week ago, he got a wild hair and drove to Dayton, grabbed her and the kids at gunpoint, and started back for San Jose with them. The Cheyenne Nation frowned.
How did you spot him?
I shrugged. She mouthed the words, help me, as I was looking at them through the window. Vic nodded and reached down to pet Dog, who had
settled between our bar stools again, giving up on going home.
Top flight police work.
I shrugged. I like to think I'm pretty keen as to what's going on around me. I guess I could have waited till she used signal flags or a carrier pigeon. Vic leaned in a little farther.
How's your chin?
Picking up my Rainier, I took a swig and then held the cool can against the scraped skin. I think I need a face transplant.
See if you can do something about that little piece of ear that's missing, too.
Thanks.
Or that scar that dissects your eye.
Okay, that's enough. I glanced up at the TV. What the hell, we're watching this again? The bear glanced over his shoulder. This is a different one. Which custer is this? Either Errol Flynn or Ronald Reagan. I think Reagan is Custer and Flynn is Jeb Stuart. He studied the screen. Or the other way around. Errol Flynn played Custer in one of these. He snapped his fingers. This is the one. I believe it is. They died with their boots on, or as we like to call it on the res, they died with their facts wrong. I think Santa Fe Trail is the one that Lucian dislikes. The Cheyenne Nation studied the screen. I can see why. The tone of the movie was pro-slavery, which I found off-putting back in the 60s and do not find any less so now, come to think of it. What's with all these Custer movies? It is the week of the battle, and TMC is showing a Custer film every night. He restored Vic's dirty martini. Personally, I am awaiting Little Big Man on Saturday. We all studied the screen with no sound. From the landscape, it looks like they fought the battle down in Wheatland. Yes, and too many chiefs and not enough Indians. Look at the number of war bonnets. You would have thought the 7th Cavalry was being attacked by an entire nation of chiefs. Fetching his soda water from the bar back, I watched as they added a strong dollop of gin. These movies make me drink. He took a swig as the swarms of Indians galloped in and out of the screen in a sort of mindless way. The battlefield does not look anything at all like the little bighorn country, and no credit is given to Gaul's infantry and Crazy Horse's cavalry, which neatly hemmed Custer's command in and then finished them off. We watched as a cinematic Flynn, the last man standing, took a bullet to the chest as yet another war-bonneted chief grabbed the stanchion of the 7th and rode off into the black and white sunset of, well, Wheatland. You think Custer was the last one killed? Do you mean was he the last one to shoot himself? He shook his head. I do not. He glanced back at the map of North and South Vietnam and the wall behind him. You remember what it was like when we were choppered into Khe San and the VC overran the barricades? Grunting into my beer, I nodded my head. I remember it most vividly. I would imagine it was like that, only a great deal worse. Sitting there safe on my bar stool, I thought about that day and, more important, the night. The confusion, the terror, the futility, and finally the exultation as we'd made it, the last being a luxury the 7th Cavalry hadn't received.
I hope you two Westerners don't mind, but this Custer stuff bores the shit out of me.
Vic, uninterested in the conversation, reached out and turned over a Durant Current, flipping a few pages as she sipped her drink.
You want to know what Custer was thinking there at the end?
The bear volunteered. Where did all these Indians come from?
Exactly.
She pulled the paper in closer.
Hey, your buddy Charles Lee Stillwater is in here.
The obituary?
Yeah,
she read and then surmised.
Doesn't sound like the Current filched out any more information than we already know.
No name and address of survivors?
No, Vic stood, a little unsteady. I think I have to go to the bathroom.
Are you okay?
Yeah, I just need to go to the bathroom. All right?
The bear studied her. There is a Custer shrine in the men's facilities, and seeing as you two are my only remaining customers, you are welcome to visit it. She placed a hand on the bar to steady herself as dog rose again, hope springing eternal.
A shrine? In the toilet?
Yes. She trundled off, walking the wooden floors of the Red Pony Bar and Grill
like they were the deck of a pitching ship heading round the horn.
Boy, you Cheyenne know how to hold a grudge.
Well, you have to remember that my people were only given citizenship in 1924. Watching her go, he turned to me. She drank a lot tonight.
I reached down and petted Dog as he sat, not completely giving up on calling it a night.
I think today was hard on her.
Because?
Kids were involved. She had to sit with them and the wife while I dealt with this Gibson guy. Studying the partial painting, I pushed it toward him.
You want something new for your shrine?
He turned the canvas and looked at the two combatants.
So, I take it, this is not an antiquity of great value.
According to the Brinton Museum, a couple $100 at best. His eyes came up and he continued to study me.
How are you?
I sighed.
Waiting on a vision, as we all are.
He glanced after Vic and then waited a moment more before introducing another mildly hurtful subject.
How is Katie?
All's quiet on the southern front.
But you have spoken to her?
Not for a couple of weeks, no. I stared at the surface of the bar, at all the little stains, nicks, and dents. Charlie Lee was one of her favorites, the first black person she ever met. He turned to the bar back and punched no sale on the mammoth brass cash register, popping open the tray and then shutting it in the beginning ritual of closing the bar I'd witnessed a million times.
If things are slow, why not go down there?
I gestured toward the closed money tray and started to get out my wallet. What do I owe you? He gestured toward the canvas.
I will take the painting for my bathroom.
I nodded, raising my beer as he lifted his own drink, and we toasted. Deal. He nodded, and I thought about Katie.
I'm not so sure she wants me down there. She loves you.
That, as you well know from your own dealings with family, does not mean she wants my company.
We could go steal your granddaughter. We Cheyenne have a long-standing tradition of such things.
And then I can go share a cell with Dean Gibson when my daughter and Assistant Attorney General get through with me?
I will come visit you in Rawlins.
He glanced over my shoulder, and I turned to watch Vic weaving between the chairs and tables, finally making it to her stool as I took her elbow and helped her get a good seat.
I think I'm drunk.
Yep, I think you are.
She glanced at Henry.
Too much fire water.
He nodded. Could be.
I've never been in the men's room before. That's some shrine you got in there.
Slipping off my stool, I stood as Dog raised his head to look at me. I'll be right back, then we'll go home, okay? Disgruntled, the Canisdiros lowered his massive head back to the floor. Crossing past the pool table, I entered the alcove and took my customary right to the bathroom door with a sign that read Brave, across from the one on the other side of the hallway that read Braver, which sometimes confused the tourists. A famous quote from the Lakota chief Red Cloud states that men do that which is difficult while women do that which is impossible. I'd been in the restroom of the Red Pony so many times that I didn't even see all the stuff, but it was testament to the bear that no one ever molested or stole the things hanging there. There were a few pieces of graffiti that had been scrawled on the walls, proclamations such as Crow got the land and Lakota got the glory, while the Cheyenne did the fighting, or pithy remarks like Custer wore arrow shirts, or Custer got sued. Fishing the business at hand, I continued to look around at the hairpipe breastplate, a faded blue kepi, and a dented bugle, and wondered how much of the stuff was real. There was artwork, too. A Kevin Red Star, a Joel Osland, and some more predictable alcohol-oriented prints, including the ubiquitous Custer's Last Fight. A Budweiser poster complete with cardboard frame that I'm pretty sure has hung at one time or another on the walls of every bar and saloon in the entire American West. Zipping up, I stepped over to the sink and washed my hands, still looking at the mass market poster over my left shoulder. I pulled out two paper towels and dried my hands as I turned to look at the dramatic display I'm sure I'd seen there the entirety of my adult life. Tossing paper towels away, I leaned in and examined the piece. At the bottom, printed into the cardboard frame, was a plate that presented Gus's last fight as a gift from the King of Beers. My eyes couldn't help but go to the center, where a long-haired Custer, replete with wind-blown red scarf, gripped an obviously empty revolver by the barrel and swung a saber. Two things as just a start. Custer had cut his hair before the battle, and the 7th Cavalry Expeditionary Force had not been issued sabers for the action. As to the scarf, I'm pretty sure that wasn't correct either. Such is the nature of nitpicking when it comes to military history. The first and foremost inaccuracy being that there were no survivors of what has long been referred to as a massacre, when, in all actuality, there were thousands. They just happened to be natives. Staring at the image of the man, historically correct or not, I couldn't help but wonder at the decision-making process that had led to his death. The personal, professional, and political demons that had rushed him headlong to his destruction on that sunny hillside on June 25, 1876. And as I stepped back a bit in order to take in a broader scope of the print, I also thought about how few times historical figures actually died alone, but at the same time, how many other lives they took with them. Just as with the movie on the television in the bar, there seemed to be an awful lot of war bonnets scattered across the battle in the poster, and even stranger were the Zulu-style shields the natives carried. The cavalrymen were definitely getting the worst of it, with some being clubbed, some stabbed, some shot, and more than a few already being scalped. It was about then that my gaze drifted to the left. There, in the corner of the print, was a strangely familiar bonneted native raising a war club in preparation of bringing it down on a soldier who hung on to his other arm. Chapter 4. It took a year to complete back in 1885 and was over 16 feet wide and 9 feet tall. Holding the large art book open, I read from page 2, an alphabetical advantage when researching an artist by the name of Adams. He was born in Zanesville, Ohio, the son of William Apthorpe Adams, a lawyer who traced his ancestry back to John Adams of Boston, one of the founding fathers. Sensing a disinterest, I raised my head to peek over the mountainous landscape of books between me and my undersheriff, who was sprawled across the surface of the Absaroka County Library table as if she were collapsed from boredom. "Can we go shoot something? Because if we don't, I think I'll just shoot myself." Ignoring her, I continued reading as a nice young lady from the front desk appeared with a few more books, depositing them onto the table with a smile and then leaving without a word. He studied at the Boston Academy of Arts under Thomas S. Noble, and later at a Cincinnati art school, and served in the Army during the Civil War, where he was wounded while aboard the USS Osage at the Battle of Vicksburg. Late in the 1870s, he moved to St. Louis, where he found work as an artist and engraver, and I guess it was there that he painted Custer's last fight. She raised her head, propping it up with a hand, elbow on the oak surface. "I'm bored." I gestured toward the miniature mountain range of books between us. "Doesn't any of this interest you?" "No." I went back to Dorothy Harmson's American Western Art. As models, he used actual Sioux Indians in battle dress and cavalrymen in uniforms of the period. Putting another book from the pile, I flipped a few pages, revealing the painting, Custer escaping the fold between two pages by a scant inch. Studying the thing, I sighed. I'd say he was relatively accurate with the cavalrymen, but half the Indians looked like Zulus. The first having failed, she tried another tack. "I'm hungry." He created it for two members of the St. Louis Art Club, which took the painting on the road and charged people 2 bits to see it. "Can we go eat?" My eyes were drawn back to the two-page spread and then to the cardboard version I'd procured from the bathroom of the Red Pony Bar and Grill. I didn't make as much as they hoped and was sold to a saloon-keeper there in St. Louis who hung it in his barroom. He snapped a finger and leveled it at me. "There's an idea. Let's go have a drink." But the saloon went bankrupt, and the painting was acquired by the largest creditor, a small local brewery owned by one Adolphus Bush. Her interest perked, if only a little.
As in the Anheuser-Busch?
Yep. In 1895, the brewery gave the painting to the 7th Cavalry, but evidently it was destroyed in a fire in 1946. Closing the tome, I placed it on a stack and reached for another. This is incredible history. Slapping a hand on top, she thwarted my progress.
This is incredible bullshit. Who cares, Walt?
Sliding the book toward me from under her hand, I flipped it open, working my way through the directory. I do.
It doesn't change anything. You've got the guy who I assume died of natural causes.
Isaac hasn't finished the autopsy just yet. I don't see what our official involvement is at this point. $1 million in a Florsheim shoebox. She sat back and looked at me.
That's going to end up going to the IRS. Case closed.
I lifted the folder that held the partial painting. And what, pray tell, do you make of this?
I, pray tell, make nothing of it.
She leaned forward, lowering her voice. It's a stupid copy somebody did of a famous painting. Get it framed and put it on your wall, or give it to Henry to put in his bathroom shrine to Custer. Opening the folder, I studied the canvas. I want to get it professionally looked at.
Where?
Cody.
Why Cody?
The Buffalo Bills Center of the West.
You're going to drive that crusty piece of canvas over to a museum in Cody?
Nodding, I gathered up the books and stood, carefully placing the partial painting and the valueless cardboard version under my arm. I've made up my mind.
Can we have lunch first?
I was thinking tomorrow, after I've had a chance to call them.
Okay.
I thought maybe I'd hit the Little Bighorn battlefield along the way or on the way back. She stood as I gathered the books, relieved that this research portion of the investigation was over.
It's on the way?
Starting out, I paused at the front desk to hand the stack over to the nice young woman there.
Sort of. Is Henry going?
Why?
Henry always goes when it's a sort of deal.
I nodded as we exited the building and climbed into my truck. I've always found it best to keep the Indian scouts close in Custer country. She reached back and pet a dog.
Amen to that.
The busy bee was pretty packed, but we were able to snag a spot at the counter. I slipped off my jacket, draped it on the stool, and studied the light reflecting off Clear Creek. Custer was a teetotaler. Vic slid onto the stool beside me.
Maybe he should have drank.
But it's funny, don't you think, that a lot of his fame is due in part to a poster printed by a brewery?
You really are into this shit, aren't you?
I shrugged. Among other things, I'm interested in what Lucian said about the commercial value of the dead and the ability of corporations to give everlasting life to individuals who might have otherwise faded into obscurity.
Walt, I read about Custer in grade school back in Philadelphia.
Yep, but would you have if that painting hadn't existed?
I thought you and Lucian agreed it was his wife who mounted that campaign to make him famous.
She did, but she couldn't be in every bar in America spreading the word. I mean, there are towns, counties, state parks, motels, restaurants, souvenir shops.
Walt, you can't credit all that to a single painting.
Maybe not, but it certainly helped.
Baloney.
We turned to find the owner and operator of the Busy Bee Cafe standing before us with an order pad in hand.
I've decided to just tell you what the special is before you ask. Thick-cut bologna sandwiches with fried green tomatoes and mayo with fries, only $4.99.
I thought about it. Is the special the usual?
No.
I'll have the usual.
Me too,
Vic nodded, and a cup of coffee. Propping both elbows onto the counter, I stared at the two of us in the bar back mirror. I just can't help but think that it was perfect timing, what with the merging of advertising and big business in the late 1800s, plus the advent of inexpensive printing processes that allowed for a relatively new innovation,
which was
color.
Oh.
Tipping my hat back, I postulated, I wonder how many of those lithographs were handed out.
Call Budweiser. I'm sure they have somebody in charge of their advertising archives. You could even fly to St. Louis and check it out.
I could.
I was joking.
Dorothy reappeared with glasses of water, and I thanked her and took a couple of sips. There were two very different types of establishments in those days, saloons and barrooms. Barrooms had sawdust on the floors and spittoons, while saloons had more refined tastes, and I can see beer salesmen coming in
and telling barroom owners that they could sure class up the place by putting one of these swell lithographs behind the bar. Swell? It was a term back in the day. Lowering my glass, I thought about it. Art is a conversation starter, something to keep people bellied up against the bar, talking, and more important, drinking. With a groan, she leaned in and spoke in a low voice. In the final analysis, what are you getting at? Turning my head, I watched as she studied the scar that darted across the skin around my left eye. Given the socio-cultural importance, what would that painting be worth today? She thought about it, and then slowly smiled the little corner of the mouth grin I found so entrancing. Enough $100 bills to fill a Florsheim shoebox? That's what I was thinking. Dumping her customary 5 sugars into her coffee, she took a sip. You were also thinking that those people over at the Cow would know. Cow? Center of the West, COW. Please don't call it that while we're over there. She went back to drinking her coffee just as the usual arrived, a grilled chicken sandwich with a side of fries. I get to go? I didn't figure there was any way to stop you. Lowering her mug, she adjusted her plate and continued to smile. No post-its?
No, no one loves you today.
Studying the empty door facing that held all my square yellow paper correspondence, Vic passed me and went toward her office as I sat on the dispatcher's desk, which always antagonized the dispatcher. Where's Sazer Pretoria? At the mention of our Basque deputy, Ruby looked up over her glasses at me as she reached down and petted Dog, who had settled in under her desk, or as much of him as the furniture would allow.
Out, taking care of the post-its.
I guessed, lost Dog. Dog raised his head to look at me and then registered it as a false call and resettled. Ruby shook her head. Somebody found a set of engagement rings in the parking lot of the Baptist church, so he went over to pick them up for the lost and found. I'll notify the paper and get it up on our website.
We have a website? She frowned at me. I'm willing to try the computer again if you want.
Having tired of my dilettante behavior toward technology, Ruby had gotten me a computer. Sazer Pretoria had assisted in getting it on my desk and up and running, but the complications of operating the thing had thwarted me at every turn, and the entire office had decided it was more trouble teaching me how to use it than it had been worth. Currently, it was downstairs on the community desk, where I sometimes paused in passing to hit the space bar to see the screensaver photo of my daughter and granddaughter.
I think we'll all pass.
Roger that, I stood. Anything need my attention?
Payroll checks need to be signed, and they're on your desk.
You know, I'm starting to feel like a turnkey around here. Dismissing me, she went back to her mound of papers.
Tell me about it.
Entering my office, I placed the artwork on my guest chair and stood there looking out the western window at the Bighorn Mountains, thinking how easy it would be to just get into the truck and head over to Cody. But realizing it wouldn't be particularly fair to my riding partners or to the Buffalo Bill Museum, which I hadn't contacted yet. Giving in to the inevitable, I sat and began signing as I flipped through the Rolodex Vic had threatened to sell on eBay, finally finding the number of the chief of staff of the venerable McCracken Research Library that lurked in the basement of the sprawling Center of the West.
Mary Robinson?
Hi, Mary, it's Walt Longmire. Adjusting the receiver in my ear, I listened as she smiled over the line.
Well, hello, Walt Longmire.
Mary, do you guys have anything on Cassidy Adams? Custer's Last Fight and Moonlight on the Mississippi?
That's him. I'm sure we have some information on him. What exactly are you looking for?
Mostly information on Custer's Last Fight.
The Budweiser painting.
For lack of a better name, yep.
You know, it burned.
I was hoping that wasn't the case, but that's what I've read. I think I might have an artist study that Cassidy may or may not have done.
Oh, my.
Anyway, I've got the thing and thought I might drive over tomorrow and have you guys take a look at it and see if it's the real deal.
We'd be happy to.
I'll just make sure our conservationist is here.
Great.
Not quite ready to hang up, I asked. Hey, Mary, let's say for the point of argument that the painting wasn't burned and had been found. What would it be worth? She laughed.
You do know the original painting was a triptych,
and that the two outer panels are at historical archives in Arizona.
What are they of?
Custer is a child, and then the aftermath of his death. They're in pretty rough shape, but worth seeing if you're really interested.
What about the worth of the painting?
The one that burned?
Yep.
You're not kidding?
Nope. There was a pause.
Well, if it were being auctioned, it would certainly be a price-on-demand sort of thing.
That doesn't answer my question.
24, 25?
I swallowed. Million?
Easily.
So if somebody were to buy it at, say, $1 million, it'd be the bargain of the century? There was another pause.
Walt, are you serious about this painting having been found? Because if you are, we here at the Buffalo Bill would be interested.
No, no, I haven't found the painting, but the artist's study we discovered was accompanied by $1 million in $100 bills. And I'm just trying to assemble where all that money could have come from.
If, and it's a big if, that painting were still in existence and was procured for $1 million, then somebody was horribly robbed.
Well, that settles a few things. Do I need to make an appointment, or can I just drop in sometime tomorrow?
I'll be here all day. We've got a syndic tomorrow night.
Anything you need from this side of the mountains?
If you run into any spectacular specimens of historic fine art that have been until lately presumed destroyed,
you're number one on my list.
Hanging up the phone, I rested my eyes on the cardboard print in the folded cardboard frame, and then the smaller, more personal struggle going on in the left lower corner.
So much for that theory. Picking up the phone again, I rang the number I knew by heart and waited. After a few rings, he picked up. It is another beautiful day here at the Red Pony Bar and Grill and continual soiree.
Do you have Prince Albert in a can?
No, we have him in a pouch, but the results are much the same. And before you ask, yes, our refrigerator is running, and no, we are not going to go catch it.
You want to come over tomorrow morning and ride in with me, and we'll pick up Vic and head over to Cody?
Certainly. I'm assuming we are spending the night. Do you still want to stop at the battlefield? I do on the way back, along with another short stop in Billings, if you do not mind. Overnight it is. The line went dead before I could ask what the other stop might be, so I hung up and raised my face to find Santiago's Sarza Victoria standing in the doorway.
So you want to get married?
I don't think you're my type.
He stepped in, handing me the small box.
Too bad, because I've got a hell of a set of rings here.
Flipping the thing open, I gazed at the intertwined 24-carat rings, encrusted with multiple diamonds and a large setting flanked on both sides.
Jeez, somebody robbed the ice plant.
I know, right?
The Baptists are taking in way too much money these days. Turning the box in my hand, I watched as the light played off the stuff dreams are made of.
Any idea?
Close to 20,000, I'd say.
Between this and the cool million I found, things are looking up here in the county.
He leaned against the wall.
So I don't get to go to Cody?
Somebody's got to stay here and collect the riches.
Handing him the rings, I eased back in my chair. Get that in the safe before you lose it. Somebody out there is having a heart attack. Looking at the box, he pushed off the wall.
If nobody collects it, can I have it?
I'm sure Marie would appreciate that, but no.
Going out the door, he stopped, and then gave me a parting shot.
First you give away our $1 million, and now this. You're not much fun these days.
You're not the first to notice.
Ruby's voice sounded from the other room.
Walt, Isaac Bloomfield, line one.
Holding a finger up to Sarza Victoria, I punched line one and lifted the receiver, holding it to my ear.
What's the word on the autopsy?
Well, hello to you, too. Heart attack. You sound disappointed.
No hint of foul play?
None that we can find other than a syringe mark where he must have had some sort of injection that night, but there's nothing in his medical chart that says he should have had one.
Nothing in the toxicology?
No. We went through Charlie Lee's medications, and he was taking an assortment of drugs that had to do with his heart, but sometimes it's just the mileage.
Nothing else?
No, I'm afraid not.
Thanks, Doc.
I hung up the phone and looked at my deputy.
Anything else?
The transport service is going to be here this afternoon to collect the Gibson guy and haul him back to San Jose, where he has a number of priors and a few outstanding warrants.
I'd forgotten about the would-be kidnapper and stood. Is he ready to go?
No, I'm heading there now. I'll go with you just in case you want to get him out. Passing through the main part of the office under Ruby's careful eye, we started down the steps to the landing and took a left toward the basement and the jail proper. The holding cells upstairs were comfy by comparison, and I slept in one on a regular basis, but very little about Gibson had recommended the man, so we'd incarcerated him in the windowless bowels of the old Carnegie building. Sizer Pretoria was just as glad to be rid of him, having tired of providing docent service for the last two nights, including shower break when the guilty man had attempted to climb out the bathroom window, only to be thwarted by the bars we'd anchored there after the last individual had escaped into the populace at large wearing only a bathrobe. Walking by the communal table, I hit the space bar and smiled back at my tiny MIA family and thought about calling Katie before following the Basco down the hallway where a completely unclothed Dean Gibson stood in the middle of the cell. "I'm not going." Sizer Pretoria glanced at me and then back at the naked man. "Excuse me? I have no reason to go back there." "Well, the state of California and Santa Clara County appear to have other opinions about that." I leaned against the bars. "You mind telling us why you don't have any clothes on, Mr. Gibson?" "I'm not going to make this easy. I got a tub of Vaseline from the bathroom and I'm all greased up, so it's going to be a fight." On closer inspection, he did have a kind of sheen to him. "To make it harder to get hold of you?" "You got it." "What, did you see that in a movie or something?" "Yeah." "Mr. Gibson, the only thing that's going to do is get you in either a straitjacket or a full harness cufflink and leg irons with a belly chain, which can be very uncomfortable for traveling in a van for 1,000 miles. He made a face. "A van? I don't even get to fly?" "It'll be a van, yep." "Fuck that! I'll fight all of you." He readjusted, feet apart, and raised his fists into boxing stance. "I was a Golden Gloves champion back in San Jose." I stared at the man for a good while and then raised my hands. "Well, we'll just wait until the transport boys get here and see how they want to handle it." "You're damn right." He threw a few punches, shadowboxing the air between us. Sizer Pretoria followed me down the hallway where I stopped to let him pass before he turned back to study me. "That's it? We're not going to secure him before they get here?" Reaching beside him, I closed the heavy metal door to the cells and then continued on before stopping at the base of the steps and jacking the air conditioning to its maximum setting. "Do me a favor and close off all the ducts out in this part of the basement." He smiled. "Yes, boss." I hung up with the manager of the IGA, confirming that, yes, the bag that had been used as a liner in the $1 million shoebox was indeed the current version the grocery chain was using. After that, I called Wes over at the bank and confirmed that, yes, the serial numbers were not consecutive and the bills ranged in date from 1952 to a year ago. "No large-sized bills?" "Not since 1927. "No silver certificates?" "No, and no Confederate money either." I repositioned the phone in my ear. "Anything on the bands?" "They're a strange color, unlike any I've ever seen, blank with white borders as opposed to ours, which are white with colored borders." "I thought they were all blank." "No, definitely two-tone, lighter than the ones we use for $1 bills in a 50-bill count. You see, when the Federal Reserve gave up counting bills by hand in the late 70s, the American Bankers Association set a standard for both the value and color of currency bands." "I had no idea." "All bills larger than $1 come in currency straps of 100, and the color allows for quick accounting, even when the bills are stacked, say, in a vault. Striped bands are only used on straps for star notes." "Okay, you got me there. What's a star note?" "A replica banknote that replaces a faulty one during regular production to account for the serial listing, but with a notation, usually a 5-point star. "Well, you learn something every day." I heard some noise out front and assumed the transport contractors were here for Gibson. "So you're telling me that every denomination has a color code. What'd you call it? Currency strap. Those used to wrap ones come in a number of colors, but fives